This podcast is brought to you by WRFL, Radio Free Lexington. Find us online at WRFL.fm. Catch us on your FM radio while you're in Central Kentucky at 88.1 FM, all the way to the left. Thank you for listening, and please be sure to subscribe.
Welcome, everyone listening to us here in Lexington. The current time is 6:06 in the evening, and because it is between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m. on a Thursday here in Lexington on WRFL Lexington, that can only mean one thing. Grant, would you care to tell the wonderful listeners what that one thing could be?
That one thing is that you are listening to WRFL Lexington, and this is Tech Talks.
That is correct. So, we will be with you for the next 2 hours talking tech and spinning tunes, and just all sorts of fun stuff lined up for you all.
That's right. We're going to be here all the way until 8 p.m., and I'm Grant, and we're here with Mitch, so it'll be a lot of fun. Isn't that right, Mitch?
It most certainly is. So some of the things we're going to be talking about tonight, I know I have a space article I want to talk about, and I imagine, Grant, that you have some space stuff, too, to talk about.
Cool. Yeah, I certainly do. We've also got some stuff coming up with some updates for Alexa, Amazon's smart home project, along with some other related features with that, so that should be pretty fun. Got some stuff coming up with Facebook, some updates with that, along with some other more, I guess you could say, researchy topics.
That's right, as well as some other big news here in the Tech Talk news drome, I guess we can call it today, is hopefully here with throughout the fall, we are going to really step up our guests. We're going to be having a lot of guests. We're going to be trying to work a lot with the College of Engineering here on campus, trying to get a lot of faculty and some other guests in, and trying to do some more stuff by connecting with them. So we'll see where that goes. Definitely hope it can work out a lot better.
Yeah, definitely. Keep it locked all the way through us, all throughout the fall semester, which we'll be starting here soon enough. It's a little bit of an intimidating thought getting back to it, but we'll be back in school here on campus, and we'll be bringing you a whole new slew of guests, technical and otherwise, all throughout the realm of science.
In addition to the fact that Tech Talks is podcasted now,
that has always
been podcasted, but now we are available on the iTunes podcast store and the Google Play podcast store. So if you miss Tech Talks, but you really like listening to us, or you think that there's a friend of yours that may enjoy listening to us as well, please feel free to recommend them to that podcast. Feel free to subscribe.
You can swing back around to our page on Facebook. The link is there. Or you can go over and find us at WRFL.fm. That's WRFL.fm/shows/Tech Talks. You can find us there. We got the links straight through the podcast and all of that other great services. So if you ever miss anything, you can always catch up with us. Otherwise, we'll be right here for the next 2 hours playing some music and hitting up the technology. By the way, Mitch, what do we got up tune-wise?
First up, as we always love to intro with this, or I do anyways, we've got Helios with the album Full Circle, and that is intro, or intro slash spectrum, going right into the second song on that album, which is Play. And it's just a really, really profound sound, I feel. And I really thoroughly enjoy it. So without further ado, let's quit talking and let's get back to the tunes. So keep it locked all the way to the left here at Tech Talks.
Current time is 6:33, and you're jumping on here with us, Lexington's very own technology radio show.
That's right. The best radio technology show in the city.
Yes.
We are. That's the best. By default.
You're right. Unchallenged. That's how good we are. We're completely unchallenged in our presentation of radio material to you. But
now, if we're wrong, please, someone correct us so we don't seem arrogant.
But really, that's what we're here to do. We're here to provide you with this week's and just kind of in general what's happening in technology and to try to digest it in a way that's both
palatable.
Yeah, palatable. And
doesn't induce heartburn.
Yeah, yeah.
So, with that, we are here again for another episode. And, Grant, what are we going to talk about first?
What are we going to talk about first? I think I'd like to start off with a little bit here about Alexa.
Okay.
Do you remember Alexa?
I do remember Alexa.
Why don't you give us a brief overview of Alexa up until now, if you don't mind.
That's Amazon's, right? Amazon's mm-hmm. Alexa. It's sort of like a small tower device, if you will, that is more or less a speaker that has a built-in Siri program called Alexa, and it can do all sorts of nifty, fun little things for you.
It integrates with your phone. It can use the Wi-Fi to look up the weather. It can read you books off of your Kindle. There's a tremendous amount of integration that's happened with Alexa, and I've been really, really impressed with the diversity of skills. In the past several months, they've released the new Echo Dot and what's the other one called? I can't think of it right now. But it's two smaller versions of Alexa. And mm-hmm. the idea is that maybe one day we'd be looking at a world in which Alexa would be integrated into your car and also in your phone and also in your house. And it would be a seamless environment of these same copies of these same programs interacting with each other to kind of carry the smart home environment outside of your home. Starting in August, you will now be able to tell your Alexa, Alexa, lock the front door.
Neat. So you're able to now fully have a smart home by just buying an Alexa and probably some Amazon-branded lock or something?
It works with a variety of locks, and there's already a couple brands that are already out there. But one of the ones in particular is a group named August. August is actually a smart lock. And so starting next month in August, you will be able to tell Alexa to tell August, which is the name of your
lock,
to lock itself. So it feels kind of roundabout. Hey, Alexa, tell August to lock the door. But whatever.
That could create some questions if you've not explained to, say, your girlfriend that you have a smart home, because all of a sudden your girlfriend's going to be like, wait a minute, who's Alexa and who's August?
Roommates, I suppose.
Okay.
Anyways. It just seems interesting to me that there's this ever-growing number of what Amazon calls skills. Basically mechanisms and things that Alexa is more and more capable of interacting with by the day. At this point, Alexa can do, I mean, a whole host of things. We're talking about everything from streaming music and including a number of outlets like Spotify to actually functioning as a radio. Reading books online. There's actually a game mode that Alexa has where it taps into Wikipedia and does trivia. Like, it's amazing to me how many things it's become capable of doing. And I'm really, really impressed with the thoughtfulness and the design. Up until now, we've seen people attempt smart home-ish things. But a smart home has to be friendly. It can't just be a sterile piece of software that locks your doors and turns the lights on and off. It's got to be something that feels almost kind of interactive. And I think that's why Siri hit it off so well when it first came out, you know? Because Siri was so personal and personable.
Yes, it was. It had a personality of its own. It was a designed personality to sort of be this snarky little, I guess, witty, clever assistant, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's...
That was emulated in Alexa, I feel, as well, because Alexa, I feel, does have also a smaller, not as prevalent, but a similarly designed personality in and of itself.
I think it does have this similar combination of wittiness and
phrases and tone and voice and inflection that gives it a slight personality without overshadowing that ultimately it's an inanimate object.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's why smart homes have had so much trouble up until now, is because we've had trouble.
And they're expensive. I mean, I hate to say it, your average American can't go out and upgrade, you know, isn't going to go out and just upgrade their locks to these Wi-Fi connected locks. Because in all honesty, those kinds of locks, when you allow that kind of access to something, it really opens you up even less securely. You know, those locks can probably be hacked.
If it's electronic and running on any level that's connected to Wi-Fi, it can be hacked.
Or even Bluetooth. I mean, if it's an electronic period and has any sort of manipulative, you know, any system that you can manipulate on it, then it can be hacked. And while, you know, a lot of technology, no matter what, is good, you know, in certain cases like locks, you know, on the average American home, that's kind of, to me, a bit of an insecurity.
Yeah, yeah, and that's fair, and that is a legitimate concern. But I think there's a lot of other aspects aside from the locks. I think the locks are just the notable piece of today.
For security-wise, that's my bit on security. But as far as like what you were saying about smart homes in general, like integrated thermostats or you know, lighting or you know, things like that, to where, okay, I'm on vacation. Well, did I forget to turn out a light or something? Let me just see. And then you get on a smartphone app and see that you've left a light on or something, and you can remotely turn that light off. Those kinds of systems are super nice. They're super convenient. They are a smart home. But at the same time, they're so expensive at this point. The internal systems of a smart home are just so expensive.
And that's a very fair thing to take up with the smart home. They are expensive.
That's kind of like the fridge. Samsung came out with a fridge recently that basically one door of it is just a big TV screen, and there are cameras on the inside of that door where you can tap on the side of the fridge, and it pulls up a TV view.
A live feed
of
the inside
of your fridge. And you can see what groceries are in your fridge or without ever having to open the door.
And I mean, clearly,
But the cool thing about that, too, is that there's a connected smartphone app to where you can, say, be at the grocery store and can't remember if something's in the fridge. You can get on your smartphone and look in your fridge and see, oh, okay, there's not enough milk. I need to get another gallon of milk while I'm here.
And clearly, you see us go from chuckling enough that it's hard to make it through the sentence, has a live feed on the inside of your fridge, but then you turn it back around and it is actually something
that's really useful.
Actually has a practical use there. And I think that's a lot of the perception that smart homes are going to have for another 5 or 10 years at least, is that they're these expensive novelties that do funny things. But it is, I think it takes someone like Amazon taking it on full head, the very mainstream way, and try and build this integration. But the nice thing that Amazon did that it did well is the fact that you can just get an Alexa and it can stand on its own. It doesn't need to have the smart lights. It doesn't need to have the smart locks. It can do other things on its own. All you need is a Wi-Fi connection, and it can read books and tell you the weather and do all of that other stuff. You know, you don't have to have the full smart home to be able to take a little bite out of it. And I think that's where it's a lot more approachable now.
Definitely, definitely. So is there anything really more on that one we want to talk about? Then I'm going to take this opportunity, if you don't care, to pull up our Facebook page real quick, Grant, and listeners as well if you want. Earlier today, about 2 hours ago, I posted an article. It was a space-related article about... There has been this star that has just baffled scientists for years now, because every 2 minutes, more specifically, according to the article, every 1.97 minutes, the star seems to increase or decrease in visible intensity. So the light sort of is always sort of blinking or slowly growing brighter, sort of like a lighthouse signal.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason for that is that it's kind of like an interstellar lighthouse is really what that star is. And what it was is the system is it was believed to only have one large red dwarf star that I think is either three times the size of our sun or three times smaller than our sun. I think it's three times the size, and it's a red dwarf star. Can you fact check me on that real quick? on that article?
It is 3 times the... Where did that go? It is a dwarf, and it is smaller than our star.
3 times smaller than our star. Okay. However, by using the Hubble telescope and in the European, I guess, Union Space Agency, their the VLT telescope, which is actually an acronym for Very Large Telescope. That is the literal name of that telescope.
At least it's not the EXLT, the Extremely Large Telescope.
Because that's a thing, too.
That's a thing as well.
Yeah. Anyways, we talked about that one day back when we did our game of what of these is real.
Is it a telescope?
That's right. So, basically, we discovered that there's actually a second star in that system. It's a binary star system, meaning there are two primary stars.
And they're very close together.
And they
orbit each other.
So the second star actually is a white dwarf. It's a white dwarf star, and it's about the same size as Earth, which is actually super tiny for a star. However, because it's a white dwarf star, its visible intensity is so much brighter because it's nuclear reactions that are going on within the star. The fusion is happening at such a higher rate.
Do you remember how much more massive that star is?
Oh, it's 200 times.
100,000 times more dense than the star at the center of our solar system. So you're talking about something that is...
the size of Earth, yet 200,000 times denser than our sun. And our sun is like, what, 300 times as dense as Earth?
Something on that scale.
I mean, so it's incredibly dense. It's the fusion happening in the core of the star is outputting so much energy that it's actually accelerating electrons in space around the star, and they are colliding with electrons from the red dwarf star every 1.97 minutes, which causes a flash of light.
Yeah, so it's kind of like holding two incredibly charged batteries, or it's really more like holding on to two live power mains and putting them...
and sparking them against each other.
Close enough to each other that they arc every now and again, on top of emitting their own light already.
Mm-hmm.
It's...
And so it's incredibly fascinating. It's honestly, I think, the first confirmed existence that we've seen of more or less a natural particle accelerator in the universe. And that is just absolutely fascinating that around this star, that it is a natural occurrence on a scale that we can't even measure compared to CERN.
It's so dense. It's so massive.
And it accelerates more particles than we can in one day than we can with CERN in a year.
Yeah. And it's such a strong field around this star that it's ionizing the nearly empty space around it and then pulverizing the other star with that energy.
It's honestly one of the most fascinating things I've seen as far as true, like, actual star occurrences. Not star systems, not planets, but as far as just stars go, it's one of the most interesting phenomena we've seen of a binary star system. So...
It's intense enough and bright enough that we can see it from this
distance. Yes, from this distance. And the star is located at how far away, does it say, roughly? I think it says it's
hard to... 380 light years away.
So, in other words, if you took a flashlight and clicked it on and clicked it off in 380 years, that light will reach this star system that we're talking about with the binary star. And which further just even boggles your mind about the actual speed of light is just so incredibly fast that in order for us to make that journey 380 light years would take us... I mean, it'd take almost probably, I want to say 3,000 years, given our current accelerating technology.
Assuming you had something that... I mean, let's be honest. Let's assume you had some kind of unlimited power source that you could just drain on forever and keep accelerating in space. Like, you know, some kind of massive nuclear core or something. Mm-hmm. It would still take you thousands upon thousands of years to get out there. It's
unless you actually were able to accelerate up to the speed of light. Even just under the speed of light, I mean, things are going to... things are supposedly going, according to Einstein's theory of relativity, are going to be super weird. So if you're able, you know, if we were able to accelerate something, because the speed of light is...
It's an asymptote. It's a cutoff point. It's a place where other things cannot occupy.
We've got it quantified in a certain extent. I'm trying to think of the actual unit of what is the speed of light.
300 million meters. 300 million
three
meters.
To the eight. Three, yeah. To the eight. It's 3^8 meters per second squared, I think.
Meters per second.
Just meters per second?
Because it's a constant speed, yeah. So we're talking about 300 million meters per second. So 3 million football fields per second.
Which
distance.
Yeah, you know, that's how long it would take for you. You know, if you're going the speed of light, it would take 1 second to go 300 million football fields, which is an insane amount. So given that fact that, you know, the speed of light is 3^8, even if you get just under 3^8, supposedly the theory of relativity is going to kick in to where even if it does take, you know, if it's just under the speed of light, it may take maybe twice the amount of times. It may take like around half a millennia to get to that star, even if we had something that could get that fast, roughly. So, you know, you're looking at something that if we had something that could get almost to the speed of light, not quite, but get right up as close to it as we could, it would probably take at least half of a millennia for any spaceship to get there. Yet, because of the distortion inside and the effects of relativity, it would probably, you know, time inside that ship would seem to be going slower. So it may take half a millennia, but it may only seem like to the ship's crew or whatever, like it would be what?
It'd feel substantially more because of that last little bit of round off.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, to them, time wouldn't pass as quickly for them.
Yeah, yeah.
They would, you know, time outside of that ship would be seem to pass a lot faster. And it's, you know, speed of light and just everything really about that in general, that field is just so fascinating to me.
Yeah, I just cranked out the math right now. And it would be 30 quadrillion meters to that star. So that is a million thousand. So that's 30 million thousand meters away.
Which is insane. That's an insane distance.
It's such a number. It's a number that's so massive. That
and the sad thing is this star is actually, as far as in terms of the entire universe, that star is relatively close.
Yeah.
And to think that something that would take or that is 300 million thousand, is that what you said?
Yeah.
300 million thousand years for us to get
meters
away is relatively close.
Yeah,
is just an insane thought, and truly is just a testament to how large the universe really is.
You know, I think that's the first time I've ever used quadrillion
in a sentence
in a serious
sense,
way, though.
Yeah.
As far as like an actual
measurement.
Yeah, because
it goes million being one, billion being two,
trillion
three, quadrillion being four,
yeah,
quintillion
30
five,
quadrillion meters.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just nuts. I never would have, you know, it's just sort of humbling, I think, you know, just to see this relatively close star that to us is an almost impossible distance to go, and yet it's relatively close and acting sort of like a lighthouse.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something occurring there naturally that we emulated before we even knew that it existed. You know, I don't think before this was cited, I don't know if there was ever another natural occurrence of a particle accelerator.
There wasn't.
And it's kind of fascinating to think, wow, we came up with the idea of a particle accelerator, yet for endless millions of years, there's been one right there.
Yeah. We just didn't know what we were looking at. And the fact that, again, we see nature exist and already being produced,
already using a methodology or a technology that we think, wow, we're so ingenious for coming up with, when in reality we're only emulating it. Electricity was just emulated from lightning.
Isn't that mankind's cause from the beginning? Is We were not strong, so we made tools and defeated animals that were larger than us. We were not able to fly, but we overcame that. We were not able to swim great distances like dolphins and sharks and whales,
but we came up with boats. You know, and in all honesty, I have no doubt in my mind that someday, you know, should humanity survive long enough, and I say that with the most hopeful expression on my face, should we avoid any catastrophic event on Earth or anything to where we as a species can actually accomplish getting up to the speed of light and can achieve faster than light travel, it's just going to be another, like, that's going to be, I think, our next big step in evolution is when we actually are able to go faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, I think there's two steps to that. The first step is getting out into the solar system and kind of
colonizing it.
Yeah. First off, we have two very easy targets in a very short distance.
Yeah.
That's already proven achievable. You know, we've already landed people on the moon, and we've already landed a whole big bunch of stuff over on Mars. I mean, there's no reason why we couldn't hit both of those targets in the next two decades. And then within the next 50 years, there will be someone who figures out how to cheat the speed of light and really, really game that long. Because, yeah, it's 30 quadrillion meters away, it's 20 trillion miles away, but that's a lot of time to accelerate, which means if you're playing the long game
in a nearly frictionless environment, I mean, you know, if we can come up with enough power, like you said, if we can come up with a power source that can get us, you know, accelerating long enough, we can honestly coast most of the way there.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can even, if we are willing to play the long game, you know, we could accelerate right up near to the speed of light on a limited source of power and then shut it down for 10, 20 years and just incrementally every so many years just click it on and give us a good old blast in the, you know, reverse direction to shed that speed. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, when we finally start asking as a species, in all honesty, when are we going to start looking to the stars? Because I hate to say it, a lot of our natural resources are things that, you know, all those non-renewable resources like iron. There's a limited amount of iron just laying around in the dirt here on Earth.
That said, it's a lot, but it's not unlimited.
Now, on the moon, the moon has an incredible amount of meteoric iron.
Yeah, almost as much as we do.
Exactly. And honestly, I don't know what lies under the moon's surface. I don't know if anyone does. I don't know if that was part of the Apollo survey mission or not. I don't know if they actually found out what lies under the crust of the moon. Is there iron there? Is it, you know, is it just literally rock? We at least know by all the impact craters on the surface of the moon that there's at least enough meteoric iron there that could sustain us for quite some time. Not to mention the untold stuff that might be laying around underneath the dirt of Mars.
Yeah. I mean, we have a good sense of what's on the surface of Mars. You know, we're a tremendous amount of iron that gives it that nice
red color,
look. And you're talking about a lot of the same elements that we see on Earth. Mm-hmm. Here, where we see lots of carbon.
Well, in all honesty, at one point, Mars wasn't an Earth-type planet.
Yeah.
And what happened was, is because Mars doesn't have such a dense core of nickel and iron like Earth does,
and
it's not quite as large, it can't generate a strong magnetic field like Earth can. And this is something we've talked about before, but Mars's magnetic gravity, the gravitational field around Mars is so weak that actual solar radiation has more or less sandblasted the atmosphere off of Mars, which is why it's so barren and desolate. It's because the atmosphere has literally been over eons blasted away by the, you know, radiation emanating from the sun, you know? And so, wow, we went over time by a lot.
Yeah.
Well,
it's 7, so...
Well, in that, we've been having a lot of stuff going on as far as these topics. It's all sort of dovetailed into the next topic of conversation, and it's really kind of the stuff that we love to talk about. We love to talk about theoretical stuff. We love to talk about space, especially, just because it's so miraculous how large space, how infinite space is, even though space at some point becomes finite. It's just an immeasurable amount of, you know, it may be immeasurable, but it is finite.
Yeah, and it is actually hard to tell exactly where that boundary is.
Well, it's hard to even know what's beyond it. You know, what is it just empty? I mean, that's the other thing, too. No one has any science. There's no scientific evidence to even come up with a hypothesis of what's beyond the edge of our universe. Is there another universe?
And that's what's so baffling about the way that that works, because there is stuff that sometimes off in the distance comes into view, so to say, because it takes a while for the light to get to us. And so we're just now seeing the edge of the observable universe. So there's stuff out beyond what's even
observable that we just don't have the technology to even see yet.
If you could move faster than the speed of light, then you could get out to a distance farther than what we've been capable of seeing. And there's something out there, because we keep encountering new nebulas and all kinds of things off in the great distance. So there's stuff there. We just have no idea what it's going to be.
Yeah, and it's just a truly humbling thing to think about how grand all of this is.
Hey there. If you're enjoying this podcast from WRFL Lexington, you may enjoy our live radio stream at WRFL.fm and, of course, via radio at 88.1 FM in the Central Kentucky area. We have a wide variety of programs you're sure to enjoy. Just go to WRFL.fm/schedule and see what programs appeal most to you. Thanks again for listening to this podcast from WRFL Lexington.
Welcome back. The current time is 7:36, and you were tuned in here with us at WRFL Lexington. So let's talk about what happened earlier this past week. Six soon-to-be astronauts spent a week hanging out in some caves in Italy as part of, and you'll love this, Mitch, it's called CAVES, the Cooperative Adventure for Valuing Exercising. Good. I'm glad that came. The exasperation came through nice and clear. That was a good one. Gotcha on the acronym. And what's funny about this is, at first you're thinking, why would they spend time running around in a cave? But it really does make a lot of sense, because the connection there is very real and direct. When you're running around in a cave, it is kind of foreign. It is kind of alien. It's very dark. There's a lot of precautions that you have to take in ways that you don't have to on the surface. There's a lot of things in that kind of a way. But this is not the first time that they've actually had, and it's the European Space Agency that leads this, groups who do teamwork exercises and spend time living in a cave. And I think it's a lot of the atmosphere there that helps it feel so much like something alien, something foreign.
When you started this article, it made me think that they were training astronauts to go to Mars, and in some catastrophic mission, if the habitat module was destroyed, to live in the Martian caves. That's where I thought this was going. I'm much more disappointed now that we're here.
Now that we're here at team building.
Now that my illusion has been shattered and it's all just team building and not surviving in a cave on another planet.
Isn't everything cool actually secretly just a team building exercise?
Explosions are cool, and I'm pretty sure they don't build teams.
I had to build teams to make those explosions happen.
Yeah, but I would probably say that no one's going to sit there and be like, wow, we accomplished something great as a team because of that explosion. Boom. No one's going... I would be very impressed if someone has had that situation where they've sat there and been like, you know what? Actually, that explosion really helped us come together as a team, guys. Way to go.
That's the speech I give every time right before I demo a building. Hey, guys, good teamwork on this project. Now let's blow this building up.
Good job just throwing explosives in a building. Let's set them off. Well, I take that back. 4th of July and fireworks being the exception to that rule. Anyways.
But yeah, it is pretty fascinating. It is pretty cool, because the group ended up spending 6 entire days at almost 1,000 meters, almost a kilometer under the ground.
It's pretty far underground.
Exploring a cave that in regions that hadn't been explored before. They were actually down there doing cartography.
I have to take a second to express the irony of this situation.
Astronauts doing splunking?
Astronauts exploring and doing cartography
on Earth.
Almost, you know, 1/3 of a mile underground. Kilometers 1/3?
It's actually roughly. Maybe a little bit over that. Kilometers okay. About...
It's less than a mile.
It's about 60% of a mile.
Cool. Yeah. So 2/3. So we've got people who normally are a mile high in space, almost 2/3 of a mile under the ground. And I can't help but find the irony that they went in the wrong direction.
That's fair.
It's really cool. I mean, I'm glad they got to go splunking. That's a lot of fun. But
yeah.
But I just have to take a second to point out that irony.
One of the big other reasons why they chose a cave as an environment...
As opposed to a small other reason?
Rather than being perhaps underwater or doing any kind of those other activities.
Hey, the underwater missions are clearly preparation for Uranus.
That's fair.
You know, whenever we finally make it out to that water planet.
That's fair.
Other than Uranus, are there any other planets that are predominantly water? Now that I'm thinking about it, I don't think there are.
None that I know of, and I think Uranus is also somewhat... gas. It's like a gas.
It's like water vapor more than it is like solid ocean.
It's actually liquid hydrogen. It's not water. It's kind of water.
Liquefied hydrogen, huh?
Yeah, it's liquid hydrogen and then liquid oxygen and then a rocky core.
I wonder what would have had to have happened for all that liquid oxygen and hydrogen to accumulate around a rock in such a manner as to create that planet. Sorry to stroll us off down into space again. This is a question I've never pondered before. Why?
Now that
I have a minor understanding of how most of this stuff works, I'm sitting here thinking, how did that happen? Follow-up question, how did Jupiter get so massive and trap all those gases?
Let's work on getting somebody from the physics department, and then we can throw all those questions at them.
How did these planets come together?
Let's work on that. Let's do an episode where we walk through the origin story of every planet in the solar system, one by one, through how they came to be and what that means. Let's work on that.
Well,
now that we're done doing brainstorming on the air, one of the big reasons why they went after it was sensory deprivation, which makes sense. I mean,
because there's not a whole lot of noise down there. It's all, you're surrounded by rock, and so it's echoey. But it's sort of like whenever you get yourself in one of those soundproof chambers, to where the only noises are coming from yourself or those around you. Those environments, humans aren't made for those environments. We're not used to those environments. If you know, there's a soundproof room that it's the most soundproof room I think ever created, and the longest that any one person has actually been able to physically stand being in that room has been at 42 minutes.
It's so quiet.
You can hear the blood pumping through your veins. It's that quiet.
It's so quiet. Its resting level is below that of a normal human's hearing. It's actually -4 decibels in the middle of a human hearing range.
Which is why you can then, at that point, hear the blood rushing through your ears and pumping. You hear your veins and your heart pumping. And after 42 minutes of just hearing yourself... hearing all the noises that your body makes that you've never heard before. A lot of people, honestly, they go kind of crazy. They have to get out of there.
Most people don't make it to that 42-minute mark, and if you go in, they usually don't let people stay much past about 10 minutes because it's just such an unnerving experience to hear your bones creak and to hear your own breathing and the closest
you can probably get to it is if you submerge yourself in a pool of water and you hear, like, you may crack your knuckles underwater.
Yeah,
that's probably the closest analogy I can make to how that probably is. Being someone who's not physically gone through it, but has been through a similar, smaller room that the resting level was much higher than that negative 4 decibels. But still, it's very disconcerting. So being in not only a kilometer underground, being in this very dark cave, feeling that you are, in fact, underground, and at any moment something could come crashing down from above, the sensory deprivation of the darkness and the echoing sounds that are just coming from you or something naturally occurring there that may be able to resonate through that chamber, it's very disconcerting, very weird, very odd. And the other thing, too, that astronauts really have to get used to is in space. The vacuum that is space, once you leave our atmosphere, sound doesn't travel in vacuum, you know? So prepping them for not being able to hear things like that is very important.
Yeah, I think you really surmised that well. There's for a lot of reasons, being in space can be extremely unnerving.
Well, it is unnerving because it's the most inhospitable environment that humans can put ourselves in, other than at the bottom of the ocean. Those are the two extremes. If you put yourself at the bottom of the ocean, if that were first of all possible, because we don't have anything at this moment that can make it down that far without being crushed by the sheer pressure of the ocean.
I mean, we can get like super reinforced submarines down there, but there's nothing.
They can't stay down there more than like 3 minutes before the pressure begins to start buckling the hull.
But the point there is that the pressure is so tremendously intense that it's not just inhospitable, it's non-existent.
Mm-hmm. The under the ocean thing is something we can just talk about later. But as far as going back to space, which is something I feel is more relevant, that I'm not going to get sidetracked and make statements that I can't back up and or don't know about. As far as space goes, it is the most inhospitable, I would say, because...
Oh, absolutely.
In the exact opposite ways of the bottom of the ocean. The bottom of the ocean seeks to crush you with the sheer weight of the ocean itself and the pressure, whereas the vacuum of space is the polar opposite, to where it sort of pulls you apart because, you know, there's, first of all, no more gravity holding you down. Secondly, I mean, there's just all sorts of weird things that happen. It's sort of like if you have the bends. When say you're diving and you resurface too quickly coming up from that pressure at the bottom, towards the, upper levels of the ocean, if you resurface too quickly, the nitrogen in your blood actually will bubble and collect. And then it causes some pretty, pretty nasty side effects. So... anyways, how about you go with the next article, Grant?
All right. Yeah, sure. So next up, one of the things that we wanted to hit was the fact that there's a lot of improvements coming to Windows 10 here soon. So we're just now past the, I believe, 1 year point of Windows 10. And so one of the big things that Windows is pushing now is virtual reality experiences within Windows 10, such that you'll be able to integrate an Oculus Rift or a number of other devices into your experience with Windows 10. And one of their first things that they're going after with is with the game Minecraft. And so I think Minecraft is actually probably a decent candidate for the Oculus and for... this sense of virtual reality, because it's so large and chunky and blocky that I don't think people will have the same violently sick reaction to it that some people have with... Well, you see where I'm going?
I would say it's because it has defined similarities from what we're used to. You know, there is a ground, there are varying heights, there are features in Minecraft. There's like a sky and there's, a ground.
And you're almost always outside and you have a good sense of which way is which.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a good sense of gravity and it's not super high resolution and all jittery, I think.
Which actually would help with the processing speed of the Oculus Rift and be able to make it more real time. Because one of the biggest problems that VR games have had so far have been trying to get it to where if you turn to your right, the video game can also render all of that as you turn and try to keep it more or less real time to where there's not some weird disconnect that causes that sickness, that VR sickness. And that VR sickness is caused by the fact I know my head is moving to the right at a certain speed, so my vision should also be at a certain point. However, because of the processing time it takes for the Oculus Rift to catch up to that, it causes a slight delay, which can be really off-putting because your body movement is one sensory input that's saying, here's what you should be seeing, and your eyes are taking a microsecond to catch up. And that disconnect there can really, I mean, can cause some problems.
Yeah, it's really jarring. It's that effect of having the lightning and the thunder separated when it feels like they should be together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's a great analogy.
It's that kind of sluggishness that it creates that makes people sick. And so mm-hmm. we're talking about something where you can turn the settings visually way down on Minecraft and get it to the point where it's almost no processing power. And I think that's one of the reasons why it will really thrive, because that's an issue that Oculus has had, is real-time rendering. Mm-hmm. With enough.
And another thing too about Minecraft is it's where it's an open world concept. Most of the world is constantly generated, and at any point do you leave one area of that world and go into another. Very rarely does that happen. Most of the time there's a physical door that'll just click open and you walk into, say, a cave, and that cave is already there. Even when you're on the surface far away from it, it's still there. You know, and I think that's part of why Minecraft would be perfect, like you said, for VR, because all of those kinds of issues have already been natively solved by just that's how the game already is.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of good reasons as to why that Minecraft would be a good candidate for this. And mm-hmm. I think this is going to be an exciting step for that game and that community, and I think there's going to be a lot of good in the way that we see VR develop.
Yep, I agree completely. What else do we have up and ready, Grant? Or is that about it for the show? Are we gonna toss it over to the Party Panda Power Hour?
We have some other stuff, but we can save that for next week.
Let's save that for next week. We'll go out to a couple songs, and we will let the Party Panda himself come in and start his panda party. Right? Is that what we're supposed to do? We're supposed to let the Party Panda Power Hour start with the host being the Party Panda, starting his panda party.
Yeah, it sounds good. So thanks for joining in with us.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in and checking out with us.
8 minutes till 8, and you were tuned in here to WRFL Lexington. I'm Grant.
And I am Mitch, and we will see you all. Actually, I might not be here next week, so we will probably... Actually, I'm going to go and say I'm not going to be here next week. So next week it'll be Grant, and if he brings any guests, then it'll probably be Grant and guest version of Tech Talks, or it may just be music. It's up to him, and he will let you know next week what he's going to do.
Yeah, I'll be probably rolling solo, so I will be here next week, and I'll see all of you next week.
All right. With that, keep it locked all the way to the left here at WRFL Lexington.